All right, this next chapter starts with a little bit of biological history. We're all used to knowing about DNA. It's the most famous chemical in the world, probably. Well, the most famous big molecule. Water is probably more famous than DNA. But anyway, everyone knows about DNA now, even if you don't know the particulars of how it works, everyone knows about DNA. But that's only fairly recently. For a lot of biological history, we had no idea about DNA or what it does. And actually, for millennia, we have noticed, without even knowing anything about biochemistry, really, we have noticed for thousands of years that there is seemingly something that gets passed on between generations, right? We notice that offspring resemble their parents, and so it seems like something's being passed on, something that is, by something I mean something that is material, some sort of substance, a heritable substance. But that doesn't mean we knew what it was. We just figured there must be. And so it was an important point in biological history when we finally experimentally demonstrated that there is a molecule of inheritance, a molecule that is responsible for giving organisms indirectly their traits. That experiment is shown here, or the results of this, in which they used non-voluntary mice that as the subjects, into which they injected some things. Now this involved bacteria that were injected into the mice, but there are two different strains of this bacterium, the so-called S strain and R strain. S and R stand for smooth and rough. This just refers to how the colonies look to the naked eye when you put them onto dishes and grow them. But the big difference is that the S cells are the dangerous ones. They're virulent. They cause pneumonia. Whereas the R strain doesn't. So they're relatively harmless. Okay, well, this explains these first two parts of the experiment. For the mice in which they injected the S strand, it's not a surprise that these mice died. I just told you that the S strand is the dangerous stuff. Right? And in the mice that they injected living R cells, also no surprise because I just told you the R cells don't cause pneumonia, so they were able to survive that. These are just controls in the experiment. Then in the third, they used S cells, which are the dangerous ones, but before injecting them, they heated the S cells to kill them. So there weren't any living bacteria. They were just dead, formerly dangerous bacteria that were injected. And once again, no surprise, these mice survived that. Because dead things don't cause disease, right? Living pathogens do. So the really important one is the fourth one, in which they also heat killed the S before injection. But instead of just giving them dead S, like they did in this third one, they mixed the dead S with living R bacteria, which are the harmless ones. And notice that those mice died. So what looks like is happening here is that some sort of substance that's in the S cells that are dead is being transferred to the living R cells, turning them into dangerous S cells. In other words, there seems to be a genetic material, a material of inheritance, a substance that controls traits. And what this actually was that was happening is what's now known as bacterial transformation. It was the first demonstration of bacterial transformation. Transformation refers to the fact that if conditions are just right, a bacterium can take up naked DNA. By naked DNA, I mean DNA that has been spilled out of a dead cell that has burst. It's just DNA in the environment, just molecules. And it's not that bacterium's DNA, it's from some other organism. But like I said, if the conditions are right, it can take up that DNA and start using it like it was its own DNA. And so now all of a sudden, in addition to its own traits that it had originally, that bacterium has new traits because it has new genes, the genes that are on the DNA that it took up. And that's called bacterial transformation. That's exactly what was happening here. So the R cells were no longer R cells. They became S cells by incorporating this new DNA. Now, this does not at all say DNA is that material. This was just an important experiment saying there is some sort of material responsible for traits. So there is a genetic material. We just, at this point, don't know what it is. Okay, so this brings us to another important experiment later on. This is slide 2. Now, once you had the breakthrough that we just talked about of saying, yes, there definitely is a molecule of inheritance, then, of course, the natural question is, what is that molecule of inheritance? And, you know, before you actually start experimenting, which is expensive and time-consuming, you just think about it for a while and try to narrow it down to make the job easier. So, you know, you kind of discount certain possibilities, like it's unlikely to be water. Don't test water and things like that. Or small molecules in general. They started by just assuming, well, it's probably a macromolecule, a big molecule, not one of these simple ones. So that brings us to the four macromolecules that we've talked about, right? Polypeptides, polysaccharides, polynucleotides, and lipids, which we knew about chemically. But we didn't know about all the functions of all four of them. Well, we had a pretty good handle of what polysaccharides and what lipids were all about. So most biologists said, let's just assume it's not those for a starting point to save time. And that left the other two, polypeptides and polynucleotides. And at the time, most biologists assumed that it was going to be polypeptides, proteins that are the genetic material. And their assumption was, well, for anything to control something so complex as heredity, it must itself be a very complex molecule, which proteins are, right? Proteins can have any shape you want because of their complexity. So that's what they assumed. But they kept polynucleotides in the running as a consideration, mostly because we knew they existed, but we really had no idea what they were for. So we said, let's narrow it down to these two to start with. Polypeptides and polynucleotides. And that brings us to this very well-designed experiment that we're looking at here, or this is a little bit of background information for this experiment, to test whether it is polynucleotides, which are nucleic acids, or polypeptides, proteins. What we're looking at here in slide 2 in the brown is just part of the surface of a bacterium. So this is really, really close up because a bacterium is tiny. And these three cyan alien-looking things are bacteriophages. Do you remember what this phage part of the word means? Same root as in phagocytosis or esophagus. It means eat. So a bacteriophage, importantly, is not a bacterium. A bacteriophage is a virus that invades bacteria. Now, of course, it doesn't really eat the bacterium, but that's why it's called that, because the bacterium dies as a result of infection with the virus. A virus, by the way, is not an organism. Why is it not an organism? What's the minimum requirement structurally for being an organism? No guesses even?
It must have a cell.
Right. An organism has to have at least one cell. And it's also not alive. Why is not virus not alive? What is life when you really get down to it?
Metabolism,
exactly. Metabolism occurs in cells. A virus is not undergoing any metabolism. A virus is really just a couple macromolecules. A virus is a polynucleotide, either an RNA or a DNA, wrapped in a protein. Well, in this case, the bacteriophages that we're looking at here happen to have DNA as their polynucleotide. So each virus here is part DNA and part protein, which is exactly the two things that biologists had narrowed down the possibilities of the genetic material being, right? Either DNA or proteins. So that's why bacteriophages are being used in this experimental design. Now, what you see happening here is that when a virus attaches to the surface of, when a bacteriophage, which is the virus, attaches to the bacterial cell, it will inject material into the cell. Now, we already know what the answer is for the genetic material, right? You already know it's DNA, but this is back when we didn't. And so the what's left behind is not part of the cell. It's just an empty shell. It's what gets injected into the bacterium that must be the genetic material. So the idea of the experiment is, let's figure out which of these two pieces of the virus, DNA or protein, is the thing that gets injected. Okay? Well, let's look at the experiment then in slide 3. To do this, they needed to keep track of the two kinds of material that the virus is made out of, protein and DNA. So they did it in two batches, each of which was labeled in a special way. This is called radio labeling, because they label the molecules with atoms, with isotopes, radioactive isotopes of the atoms. Remember isotopes, the different versions of the same element but with different neutrons? Well, if you have a radioactive version of an isotope, you can keep track of where it is because you can detect the radiation that it's giving off, the radioactivity. All right? So in the pink batch, they produced a bunch of copies of the virus in a medium that was enriched with sulfur 35, radioactive sulfur. Now, why did they choose radioactive sulfur? Because they want to label just one of the two materials and not the other. Because if they're both labeled, they'll both be radioactive, and you can't tell which one you're getting the radioactivity from. And they chose sulfur because DNA does not include any sulfur. But proteins can have sulfur in them. Not all of the amino acids have sulfur, but there are sulfur-containing amino acids, so therefore there's sulfur-containing protein. Well, when you give them only radioactive sulfur as the possible sulfurs, then the proteins that get built become radioactive. All right? So the radioactive sulfur labels the protein, but not the DNA. In the blue batch, meanwhile, they did the same thing but used radioactive phosphorus atoms. And that's a good choice also, because not only does DNA contain phosphorus, but every single nucleotide has phosphorus, right? Every nucleotide has a phosphate group as one of the three components of the nucleotide. So a DNA, which is millions or thousands at least of nucleotides long, has a lot of phosphorus in it. That labeled the DNA, but not the protein. Okay, then they one day figured out that the perfect tool for this, well, before I get to the perfect tool, what they needed, that they just let the bacterial cells be infected by these viruses. They exposed them to them, the labeled viruses. So they did the same thing in each of the two solutions. But they needed something that would then knock off the empty shells that remain on the surface of the bacterium after they've injected whatever it is they're injecting, which they didn't know at the time. And they realized one day that the perfect tool for this is really just a standard bar blender, because it stirs the solution fast enough to break off these empty shells, but doesn't stir them so fast that it explodes the bacterial cells. If you break the cells, they just release all the stuff that's been injected, so you've lost all your work, right? You need to have the cells intact, but the shells knocked off. And a bar blender did the perfect job for that. So they did that with each of the two solutions, pink and blue. And then they took a sample from each one and put it into a centrifuge. And a centrifuge, as you know, spins and creates G-forces. So it's a separation technique. The heavier things in the tube are going to fall to the bottom, and the lighter stuff is going to float above it. Okay, they did that for both. Well, in both pink and blue solutions, the heaviest stuff were the cells, and everything else was above that. And then they looked where the radiation is. They detected the radioactivity. Well, in the pink one, the heavy cells on the bottom didn't have any radioactivity, only the supernatant, the stuff that floats above it, did, which is the empty shells, right? So since this was the pink batch was the one that labeled the proteins, that meant the proteins were left behind. They're the shells. And in the other one, the radioactivity was in the cells themselves at the bottom. That included the DNA. It showed that the DNA was the thing that got injected into the cells. And therefore, DNA is the genetic material. So it's a really good design. Now, this convinced only some biologists. As persuasive as these results are, there were still some biologists at the time who were hanging on to this idea that it must be protein, even though they just got direct evidence that it's not. Because they just couldn't believe that it wouldn't be protein, since it seemingly requires something to be complex for it to be the genetic material. So, you know, some biologists just said, okay, well, this proves that DNA is the genetic material for bacteria, but for something complex like a human, it must be protein. Well, eventually they came around and realized they were wrong, and it's DNA is the genetic material for all organisms. Let's take a look at DNA in slide 4. Now, this is just a tiny, tiny fragment of DNA. A DNA that makes up a chromosome is enormously long in terms of nucleotides that are made out of it. Remember that nucleic acids is just one name. We can also call them polynucleotides. A polynucleotide, as the name implies, though, is a polymer. Remember that only three of the four macromolecule types are polymers. The one that's not are lipids. The others are polysaccharides, polypeptides, and polynucleotides. And the word polynucleotide means many nucleotides. So the word tells you that a nucleic acid or polynucleotide is made by hooking together a bunch of nucleotides. And once again, remember that even though a nucleotide is a monomer, one part of the polymer, the nucleotide itself actually has three parts, right? A sugar, a pentose sugar, and in the case of DNA, if that's what you're building, because there's two kinds of nucleic acids, DNA and RNA, if you're building DNA, then it's not only a pentose sugar, it's specifically deoxyribose. And that's true for every one of the nucleotides, for however many there are. There are millions of nucleotides in a strand of DNA in one of your chromosomes. That's why I said this is a little tiny stretch. And that's why it fades off at the end. This is the whole thing. But anyway, you have a deoxyribose as the sugar. And connected to that, you have some sort of nitrogenous base. So we've already been through the fact that if DNA is the nucleic acid being built, then there are four normal choices for the nitrogenous base. That's why four are shown here. Thymine, adenine, cytosine, and guanine. Uracil is not used for nucleotides of DNA. It's used for RNA instead of thymine. Okay, so these are the DNA nitrogenous bases. Each one is hooked on to one deoxyribose. And then on the other end of the deoxyribose sugar is the third component of a nucleotide, which is a phosphate. DNA serves as an informational molecule. It conveys information by virtue of it having a sequence of nucleotides. So the information that DNA carries is the specific sequence of nucleotides. Just like a sequence of numbers gives you the information for how to call someone on a phone. Only that sequence is the correct information, right? Specifically, every different sequence of DNA conveys different information. So in order for DNA to maintain that information, in order for the information not to be lost, in other words, it's really important for that sequence, which is the information, the sequence of nucleotides, to remain that sequence. In other words, it's important for a strand of DNA, which is what we're looking at here, to not fall apart. For a DNA sequence not to fall apart means you better use strong chemical bonds to hold the nucleotides together. And that is what's occurring in the blue shaded part of the figure here. Nucleotides are joined together, but notice that that does not at all involve the nitrogenous bases. They're not hooked to each other. The only thing that hooks two nucleotides together in the sequence is a covalent bond, and therefore a strong bond, between the phosphate of one nucleotide and the sugar of the next nucleotide. This black line is a covalent bond between those. And that's, you know that covalent bonds are the strongest bonds. That's important because if these were easily broken bonds, then this sequence could just fall apart. Right? Like accidentally dropping a Scrabble board on the floor. All the tiles are mixed up now. You have no idea what the words were anymore. So what's highlighted in blue here is called the sugar phosphate backbone, because only those two parts of the nucleotides are involved in holding the thing together along its length. That's what maintains the integrity of the information. The nitrogenous bases are not at all involved in holding it together. Notice that they are just hanging off of the sugar phosphate backbone. This is kind of similar to the R groups of amino acids. When you think about building a protein, remember that the R groups are the variable part of the amino acid. And when you build a polypeptide, you hook together amino acids by hooking the amino group of one amino acid to the carboxyl group of the next amino acid. The R groups are not involved in that at all. They're just hanging off. Well, here are these hanging off nitrogenous bases, even though they don't hold it together at all, are really what gives this thing information. The sugar phosphate backbone, every sugar is the same here, every phosphate is the same. So that's not really a sequence of anything meaningful, right? The sequence that gives it actually a code is that you have four different choices at each position for the nitrogenous base. They don't have to hold it together, but they have to be there to be the code. Those are like the numerals in the phone number I was talking about, or letters in a word. All right, now to five, a little bit more history, not very much, but once we have shown by that second experiment we looked at that DNA was the genetic material, then of course the big question is, how does DNA work? Well, you can't really answer the question of how DNA works until you first figure out what DNA looks like chemically. What is the structure, the molecular structure of DNA? And so there was a lot of effort put into figuring that out. Two men eventually got the credit. Watson and Crick got the Nobel Prize for that, and their work was important, definitely. But at the time, this woman was not credited, and she never really got any credit until after she was dead, because she died of cancer early. But this is Rosalind Franklin, who helped Watson and Crick greatly. Rosalind Franklin was already an expert in a technique called X-ray crystallography. Which is a method in which you shine X-rays onto some molecule that you don't know the shape of, and the X-rays will be deflected in different directions before they hit a photographic plate, just like when you make an X-ray of bones. And by looking at the pattern that's made on the X-ray, you can maybe figure out what the shape of the molecule is. That's what she was an expert in. And Watson and Crick were helped by Rosalind Franklin by this image that she created and analyzed. Now, this is a really famous image. It doesn't look much to us. But to her, she said, well, this pattern to me looks like you're talking about a helix, a helical shape. And, of course, that's what DNA's shape is. It's defined as a double helix. So she was, her contribution was pretty important. We can see in slide 6 a cartoon version. Once again, it's just a little short sequence. We can see the cartoon version of this double helical shape. It's double helical because there are really two helices. A helix is a corkscrew shape. And so the blue band here, and there's two different blue bands because there's two different strands here, but each strand features one blue band that represents the sugar phosphate backbone of that strand, as I just told you about. That's what's holding it together. And then the A's, T's, C's, and G's, of course, are the nitrogenous bases that stick off of that sugar phosphate backbone. And that one strand has a corkscrew shape as you go along its length. Well, associated with, well, just that one strand, by the way, is a complete molecule. It's a polynucleotide, right? Because you've hooked a bunch of nucleotides together to make it. So one DNA strand is already a complete molecule. But what we call a DNA is really two molecules in one. It's two polynucleotides. In other words, two strands of DNA, each of which has this helical shape, but they're associated with each other in such a way that the nitrogenous bases hanging off of one backbone, one strand, are kind of like half of a step in a spiral staircase. And the other half of each step is formed by a nitrogenous base hanging off of the other molecule's strand. So it's two polynucleotides in one, held together by what are represented here by these pink ellipses, these dots, those are hydrogen bonds. Okay, now in the middle figure, to make it easier to look at, what we've done is untwist the spiral staircase. In other words, we made it into a ladder instead, right? An untwisted spiral staircase is a ladder, really, when you get down to it. And so here you can see that each of these rungs or steps of the ladder is made by half of it is made by one nitrogenous base on one strand, half by a nitrogenous base on the other strand. That's why we call it a double helix. So when we say one DNA, molecularly speaking, that's really two different molecules. It's similar to a multimeric protein. Remember that definition? Multimeric proteins are the ones that have quaternary structure. So they consist of two or more polypeptides held together somehow. Well, each polypeptide is itself a full molecule, really. And so a multimeric protein, even though we call it one protein, is really more than one molecule. Similarly for DNA. Another thing that you see in this middle figure is that the two strands of DNA have what is called an anti-parallel arrangement. To define that, we first have to just concentrate on one strand. One strand of DNA, however long it is, even one nucleotide, and you saw this by playing with the puzzles this week. One or more nucleotides forming a strand has polarity. Nothing to do with charge, simply means that two ends are different in somehow. It has polarity because one end of the strand is going to have a phosphate sticking off of it that's not hooked to anything else, because that's the last nucleotide, right? And what you learned is that the phosphate is connected to the fifth carbon of the deoxyribose sugar. That's why the end of the strand that has the phosphate hanging off is called the 5' end. 5' refers to the fact that it's associated with the fifth of the carbon. This is the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth carbon. The other end, on the other hand, has a hydroxyl hanging off of it, not a phosphate. And the hydroxyl is associated with the third carbon of the sugar. So that's the so-called 3' end. Any strand or any single nucleotide has a 3' end and a 5' end. Well, the anti-parallel arrangement I was talking about means that one strand has its 5' end matched up against the 3' end of the other strand, and vice versa. So it's kind of like this, a head-to-tail arrangement, rather than this, head-to-head. That's anti-parallel. Now, when it comes to the steps of the ladder, I told you that these pink dots represent hydrogen bonds. That's what's holding the two polynucleotides together. They still really are separate molecules, but they're associated with each other and held in place because of hydrogen bonding between nitrogenous bases at the same position but on different strands. Is that clear? Now, what do you know about hydrogen bonds that you've learned in here? They're weak. And this is just as important as it is for the covalent bonds holding the sugar phosphate backbone together being strong is. Right? These have to be strong bonds because you can't let the strand get disintegrated or you've lost the information. But on the other hand, you have to have weak bonds holding the two strands together because either of the two major functions of DNA, which remember are transcription and DNA replication, either one of those requires reading the code for it to happen. And you can't read the code unless you separate the two strands temporarily from each other. So it needs to be easy to do. And the easiest you can make that happen and still hold them together is by using a weak hydrogen bond. So that explains that. But importantly, it's not just any nitrogenous base that can be matched up with just any nitrogenous base in the other strand. So in addition to having an anti-parallel arrangement, DNA, a double-stranded DNA, which is what DNA is, it's double-stranded, features what's called complementarity with an E, not an I. That's complementarity is the noun. We say that it's complementary. What complementarity means is that whatever the nitrogenous base is on one strand, only a complementary, or in a sense opposite, nitrogenous base can be in the same position on the other strand. And specifically, wherever you have an A, it's going to match up with a T. Wherever you have a T, it's going to match up with an A. Wherever you have a C, it's going to match up with a G. Wherever you have a G, it's going to match up with C, just like you see here. In other words, not A and C, or A and A, or A and G. A always with T. T always with A. That's known as complementarity. And without that important property, DNA would not work. It would not be able to operate for replication. Replication requires making an exact copy, not just a new DNA. It has to be exactly the same sequence of DNA when DNA gets replicated. And it's able to do that, as we'll explain more, because of complementarity. All right, let's go on to 7. There used to be a guy called Chargaff, for which we still refer to, now that he's dead, we still talk about Chargaff's rules. But Chargaff was a scientist who was interested in DNA and just isolated DNA from all kinds of different organisms, very highly unrelated to each other. You know, trees, whales, whatever. And he chemically analyzed the DNA, including figuring out how much of the each of the four kinds of nitrogenous bases there were in a sample of DNA. And one thing he noticed is that no matter what he took the DNA out of, what kind of organism, he always had as much adenine as thymine, and he always had as much cytosine as guanine. Well, what I just told you explains that, right? A always matches with T, and C always matches with G. That's why you would always have the same amount of cytosine as guanine, and so on. That's strict complementarity. A always with T is strict complementarity, and C always with G. Well, I don't remember whether I mentioned it when we first took a look at DNA several chapters ago, when we first talked about nitrogenous bases. But although there are four DNA nitrogenous bases, there's two categories. And those categories are purines and pyrimidines. Did I give you these words at the time? I don't remember. The difference between the two, the reason there are two categories, is that purines have two rings in their structure. And only the rings are shown here for simplicity. And the pyrimidines have only one ring. So there's four overall nitrogenous bases, but two of them are purines and two of them are pyrimidines. All right. And I used to always forget which ones were which. Well, it's the two pyrimidines are thymine and cytosine, T and C. And the two purines are guanine and adenine. And that's what I always kept forgetting until one day I realized when I looked at the words that the word pyrimidine has a Y in it, and so do the two pyrimidines' names. Thymine and cytosine both have a Y as well. So hopefully you can remember it that way. But anyway, the reason this is important is that part of complementarity is explained just when you think about constructing this ladder. Now, it's really a spiral staircase, like I said, but it's easier to think of as a ladder because you don't have to twist it. Each step, though, is two different nitrogenous bases, right? One on one vertical part of the ladder, whatever that's called, the rail, whatever. And the one is on the other vertical part of the ladder, which are the sugar phosphate backbones. If you just allowed any nitrogenous base to bond with, correspond at the same position on the other strand with any other nitrogenous base, then you could have any combination of purines and pyrimidines. If you had two purines coming together, like you have here, then that would mean the step would have to be wider because there's two rings in purines. If you got two pyrimidines together, it would have to be a much narrower step. And therefore, you wouldn't have a normal ladder. It would be zigzag, right, depending on what the length of the step is. But if you just always ensure that you use one purine and one pyrimidine, it doesn't matter which side the purine's on, one purine and one pyrimidine is always going to add up to the same width of the step. Right? So you make a nice normal ladder, in other words. So that explains part of strict complementarity. That explains why there's always a purine corresponding to a pyrimidine. But it doesn't explain strict complementarity entirely, because if the only requirement is purine and pyrimidine, then adenine, which is a purine, could bind with either thymine, a pyrimidine, or cytosine, a pyrimidine. You see what I'm saying here? It would still be the same width, so that wouldn't be the problem. There must be something else, and therefore, to explain the rest of complementarity, other than this size issue. And that's what slide 8 explains. So here we have adenine binding with thymine, which is what happens in DNA, and cytosine and guanine on the bottom also happens. Now we can see why it's not only always purine with pyrimidine, but specifically adenine with thymine and guanine with cytosine. The reason is that both adenine and thymine are able to produce two hydrogen bonds, so they match up perfectly. Guanine and cytosine, on the other hand, are each able to produce three hydrogen bonds, so they match up perfectly. And that's why you have strict complementarity, which is a big deal. Because without strict complementarity, you wouldn't have DNA being able to function as a template for how to build a copy of itself, which will make more sense when we look at that. Actually, right now. Slide 9. For this slide and several slides after this, the book this came from uses the scheme of dark blue versus light blue. Dark blue represents older original DNA material, and light blue is brand new DNA material that's being produced. Okay? But what we have here on the left is an original DNA molecule, just a little piece of it. Of course, it would be millions of A's, T's, C's, and G's long. But we can see this follows what strict complementarity is, right? A is always with T, C is always with G. The sequence along one strand can be anything. But you have strict complementarity between the two strands. So wherever you have an A, it's always with a T on the other strand, and so on. Well, here is why strict complementarity is so important. And this is what Watson and Crick noticed when they figured out the shape finally. If this is the DNA, and you know what that the sequences are, you could hide one of those strands from me entirely and show me just one of them, and I could tell you exactly what the other strand sequence is, right? Simply by the rules of complementarity. So if I don't look at this one on the right, I can tell you that it's T, G, A, T, C. Those go along with the sequence that's in the one I can see. In other words, because of strict complementarity, if you separate two strands of the DNA, each strand tells you how the other strand would have to be built. Tells you what the sequence would have to be, right? Which means each separated strand can serve as a template for how to build a copy of the other strand that's been taken away from it. And that's exactly what's happening here. You separate the two strands, and this is why you need hydrogen bonds, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to easily separate them. Separate the two strands, and now each strand is operating as a template. This left strand, which is the dark blue original material, tells the cell, okay, we need the sequence TGATC to be built, and so on for all the rest of the nucleotides along its length. Meanwhile, the one on the right original material tells the cell, okay, we need ACTAG. And when both of those happen, you're left with two double-stranded DNAs that are identical to each other, and they're both identical to the original DNA. Only because of strict complementarity. And this is exactly what has to happen in a cell if it has a chance of successfully dividing into viable cells. It's the only way you can give each of the two cells all of your DNA is if you first make an exact copy of your own DNA. And that's what happens in DNA replication. When does that occur? In the S phase of interphase of the cell cycle, exactly. That's when what's represented here happens. The light blue is new material, but it's exactly the same as the old material that you took from it. Okay, now, there's really, mathematically speaking, three possibilities for how this could occur. And those are represented in slide 10 and named the conservative model, the semi-conservative model, and the dispersive model. And there's really no other possibility, logically speaking, or mathematically speaking. But let me explain the difference. In the conservative model, and only one of these is true, I'm just saying these are three possibilities being considered. In the conservative model, it's fully conservative, meaning that this double-stranded original DNA is still intact in one of the cells that it splits into, but it's somehow used as a code to build a totally brand new double-stranded DNA with both strands being new material, light blue. Okay, that's fully conservative. The semi-conservative model uses one of the original strands, keeps it intact, and builds a brand new strand that it mates with. And then the other original strand is kept intact, and a new strand is used to mate with it. Okay, that's semi-conservative. Both of those are called conservative because the original strand does not get chopped up. The dispersive model is the least likely to be true, but it's also a possibility, so it has to be considered. And this does involve chopping up a strand, each strand. So in the dispersive model, the original DNA is here. It somehow gets, the strands of it get broken into pieces, which code for new material that then gets incorporated so that the next generation of DNA, each strand is partly old and partly new material. And that's why it's the least likely, because it's the most complicated, right? It would imagine a way that that would happen. It would require a lot of careful stuff to happen. Well, in science, you can't just say it's one or the other. You have to demonstrate it. So one of these must be true, since these are the three possibilities. And another famous experiment, summarized in 11, showed which one. In this experiment, they used another kind of labeling, but not radio labeling. It wasn't radioactive isotopes they used. They just used isotopes, but they were not radioactive. Isotopes of the same element differ in their number of neutrons, right? So the two different versions of the same element have different masses. One of them is heavier than the other, in other words. So in this case, when you label things this way, you can figure out where they are. You can separate them from each other by centrifugation. The heavier stuff that has that heavier isotope is going to go farther down in the tube. So that's what they did here. And that's all the explanation I'll give to you. I won't elaborate on it. But notice that right away, they refuted the conservative model. Because if the conservative model were true, then you should have two bands in your centrifuge tube. One farther down representing the fully original material, and one farther up, because it's lighter, made out of completely new material. Well, that didn't happen. They only had one band. So that was enough to say conservative is wrong. But both the semi-conservative and dispersive model involve DNA that's half old and half new, just in different ways. So they both predict that you would get just one band. And therefore, it wasn't enough to just do it one generation. They then had to do it for another generation of cells. And when they did that, if the dispersive model were true, you would still get one band. It would just be lighter and lighter every generation. Well, that didn't happen either. So that by doing it for another generation, they disproved dispersive. And what the semi-conservative model predicts is that you'll get two bands, because one of them will be half old and half new, and the other will be totally new because it's a new generation. All right? This is kind of explained also in the previous slide. This second replication, once this one separates, you're going to get half old and half new, but this new one is also going to be make a new one, so this is doubly new. You see what I'm saying? You have two different kinds here. And that's exactly what they found, two bands in the second generation, second replication. So the semi-conservative model is the correct way. That's really how DNA actually does replicate, semi-conservatively. And therefore, we need to talk about how DNA replication occurs. I just told you it happens semi-conservatively, but we need to look at the steps. And let's just call it a week there. It's kind of a new topic, so it's a good place to pause. If you don't mind.